All right, so. So I'm going to talk about type 2B string theory today. And I'm going to explain a feature which seems to have been overlooked for the 20 or 30 years that people have been doing type 2B string theory. But this is a kind of mixed audience, and so there are various moving parts in this talk, and there's almost nobody in the room other than me who knows all of, who knows about all of them. So I'm going to have to say some things that will be too slow for some people at various times, and hopefully, anyway, hopefully everybody will follow. So first I want to make a few general remarks about gauge theories. So gauge theories are an important thing in physics. So if you have a physical theory with some kind of symmetry, well, there's an interesting kind of possible symmetry of a physical theory in which the symmetry can vary from point to point. So typically in a gauge theory, we speak of a gauge group. But then the actual symmetry transformations are essentially maps from the space-time that we have into the gauge group so that you have a different symmetry acting at each point. So these are local physical theories. They're field theories, so they have things defined on this space-time X, and the symmetry will act locally on whatever's happening with that particular field in that particular place, and the symmetry can vary from point to point. Now, when you have a gauge theory, the gauge group, so the gauge group in a gauge theory should be physically unobservable directly, should not be observable directly. And in fact, there's a sort of quest for finding gauge invariant quantities, which are the ones that you'll be able to measure. So just to give an example, you might have some kind of bundle over space-time, and you might have, so this could be a G bundle, and so you might have a connection as the physical field, which isn't quite well-defined because it's defined only up to this gauge transformation. So you could have a connection on the bundle, and you might use a choice of connection to help formulate the theory. But then there are things like F, which is the curvature of the connection, which are gauge invariant. And that's the sort of thing which is actually observable in some sense. So ideally, one might be able to formulate gauge theories without ever making reference to the thing upon which the group acts, but often it's either more convenient to describe the theory that way, or we don't know a fully gauge invariant formulation of the theory, and so we introduce these fields which can change under these local symmetries, but we understand that the physical outcome at the end is only going to depend on gauge invariant quantities. So that's just a little bit of philosophy. Okay, so right. So that was section one. Just a little bit of philosophy about gauge theory. That was, so section of section zero. Section one is a little bit of philosophies about spinners and a slight variant of spinners called spin C structures. So physicists learn about spinners. Physicists doing particle theory or gravitational theories learn about spinners at an early age. Mathematicians don't always learn about them. So I just want to say a few words about what spinners are. So my x over here was a space-time, and it's going to be a space-time again. And what is a spacetime? A spacetime is going to be a pseudo-Riemannian manifold. So that means it's equipped with a norm on each tangent space. So the tangent bundles has an inner product, non-degenerate inner product. And there are lots of ways in which that's just the same as the theory in which you take a positive definite inner product, but in fact, it's sort of important for relativistic theories that you allow a slightly more general form of inner products. And there's a natural bundle that you can form from that structure called the frame bundle. Frame bundle F over X. And the frame bundle is choices of orthonormal frame. Okay, so what does orthonormal mean when the inner product is not positive definite? The normal means that the length of each vector is plus or minus 1. Choices of orthonormal frame in each tangent space. And as I hope everybody knows, those are acted upon transitively by the orthogonal group. So that's a principle SO bundle. And I didn't really say what the dimension was, and I didn't say how many negative eigenvalues my metric was. In the case mathematicians care about is a positive definite guy, and I'm talking about SON. In the case physicists care about most, it's got one positive and mostly negative eigenvalues, or one negative and mostly positive. They're different conventions, East Coast and West Coast conventions, some people call them. So that's a very nice structure to have. So how do people formulate relativistic field theories? Well, they want to look at a special case of this. You could do it on the bundle, but let's just start with a special case. The special case is to use a flat space-time. So I'm calling it PQ. PQ is really going to be either N0 or N-1-1, typically. But there's nothing which stops me. Okay, so why is the table up here? We're reducing the room in all possible ways in this new setup. Of course, it's missing a wheel or something. Okay. Maybe I'll do this. Start with flat space-time, and so there's a big symmetry group for this flat space-time. So there's the SOPQ symmetry, but there's also a translational symmetry. And this is called the, it's called the Poincaré or Euclidean group, depending on which of the two signature cases you have. So it's called Poincaré in N-1-1, it's Euclidean in N0, where we include rotations or the generalization of rotations in indefinite signature, as well as shifts. So the way that physicists formulate field theories is to use the representation theory, representations of this Poincaré group. Or if you're doing the so-called Euclidean field theory, you would use the Euclidean group, correspond to particles or fields. There's a little duality between particles and fields. I'm not going to make too much of that, but to correspond to types of objects being studied in the physical theory. I'm not going to review all of field theory now because I would never get to my story. But if I'm going to discuss a field theory, then I'll discuss various kinds of objects which are going to be given by a representation. And typically, you can label them. So they're typically labeled. by representations of, well, let me just say, a subgroup of SOPQ. But for it's simpler to just pretend, well, they are representations of SOPQ. So that's the sort of story of how you would formulate a relativistic theory up until the 1930s, roughly speaking. And the problem with this is that the particles that you're easily able to formulate, so you can formulate a theory which includes things like photons, or, okay, I guess if I'm trying to be historically accurate, I will not talk about non-abelian gauge theory before 1930, because that doesn't work. But I can formulate theories of things like photons, or in general, bosonic fields, what are now called bosonic fields. But I have trouble with fermionic fields, such as the electron. And Dirac realized that the problem essentially had to do with the limited possible number of representations of SOPQ. There's a very cool fact in Lie group theory that the fundamental group of SOPQ is Z mod 2 if P plus Q is bigger than 2. And so there's a double cover, which is called spin PQ over SOPQ. And there are more representations available if you go to that double cover. I do apologize to the physicists in the room and some of the mathematicians who I'm boring to tears with this little review, but it'll be over soon. For example, if I do SO3, then the double cover of SO3 is SU2, and hopefully almost everybody knows the representation theory for SU2. So you start out with a complex two-dimensional representation, and then you take its symmetric powers. So if you take the, if you look at the dimension of the kth symmetric power of the complex two-dimensional representation, that dimension is k plus 1. And the center of SU2, the thing you mod out by to get SO3, is minus the identity matrix, the 2x2 identity matrix. And so minus the 2x2 identity matrix acts non-trivially on C2, sim 3 C2, this just means polynomials in those variables, sim 5 C2, and so on. But it acts trivially on sim 2 C2, sim 4 C2, and so on. Well, and if it acts trivially, then it descends to a representation of SO3. So this problem of missing representations is very visible right here. The representation, which is usually thought of as the fundamental one, the so-called vector representation, which is three-dimensional. Okay, it's a real representation. I'm not paying too much attention to reality conditions right now. That corresponds to this. This is dimension 3. And then you can start building other representations out of that in a natural way. Whereas the representation of dimension 2 doesn't make sense as a representation of SO3, but makes sense as a representation of SU2. So, moreover, these representations are labeled by the eigenvalues of a Cartan subgroup acting on. I should talk about the algebra. They're labeled by the eigenvalues of a Cartan subalgebra acting on the root spaces. The eigenvalues of the Cartan subalgebra acting on the representation space, and the usual convention in physics is to assign a so-called spin, which labels that representation by an integer value here, and then you're forced, when you start to think about it, to use half integer values here. So you have some U1 sitting inside of SU2, and that U1 sitting inside of SU2 helps you to label what's going on with the representation, and you get different possible eigenvalues, and the convention in physics for a long time has been to use half-integer values as well as integer values. Sometimes mathematicians normalize it to use integer and twice-integer values. So that's sort of the story of how passing to this double cover allows more representations. And fermionic fields are ones which so we should actually not use Poincaré, but we should use the double cover of Poincaré, which corresponds to this double cover of the orthogonal group. And then the fermionic fields correspond to representations which don't descend to the SOPQ. Right, and the other example I wanted to give was if I had SO2. So SU2 is also known as spin 3. And if I had SO2 covered by spin 2, well, SO2 is the exception to this statement. Pi 1 of SO2 is Z. But it has a canonical index 2 subgroup. And so the double cover that you get is called spin 2. And those are both copies of the circle group, but if you mod out by the 180 degree rotation in one circle group, you get back to the other circle group. And for reasons that will be clear as we go along, I'm going to sort of name those two circle groups, spin 2 and SO2, and keep track of them that way. Okay, so what I want to talk about are supersymmetric theories. And in supersymmetric theories, there is some kind of odd, and that's a technical term, there's some kind of odd symmetry. It doesn't mean it's just a strange symmetry. They have an odd symmetry, and this odd symmetry kind of exchanges the bosons, which are represented by, which can be represented down on the orthogonal group, with fermions. And as a result, typically in a supersymmetric theory, you need a lift of the frame bundle, that bundle that had structure group, the orthogonal group, to a spinner bundle. And whether or not you can do that is the question of whether the underlying manifold is a spin manifold or not. So I'm formulating it on Minkowski or Euclidean space to begin with, thinking about that formulation as telling me what representations I need to work with. But now, on more general spacetimes, I'll use something like the frame bundle, which gives me the orthogonal group part, and then I might have to lift to a double cover of that, the spinner bundle, if I wanted a theory that had fermions. However, there is a situation in which that analysis is a little bit simplistic, and it has to do with something known as a spin-C structure. So this is a sort of account for the...
Question?
Yeah.
Is this with or without supersymmetry? Does it matter whether there is supersymmetry or not? This is just the existence...
No. Supersymmetry implies... So to have fermions in my theory, I have to have... at least I have to have some bundle that's transforming like a spinner. Right. That's not quite right.
If you just have bosons and fermions, but no supersymmetry, wouldn't you still require?
There could be there. I'm about to say that's not the case, so we'll see why I say that's not the case.
Okay.
Yes.
I think it's the same question, but I'm not
yes.
sure. So there's like a language problem that I've run into at times is distinguishing between like when there's odd and even fields and you call it a super theory, or when like in 2D CFT you have Virasoro versus super Virasoro. And I guess you need one for the other. Like if you're gonna have it's like super symmetry versus super fields, or but I don't actually speak the language.
Right. So the interesting thing about superstring theory is that there are two supersymmetries in superstring theory. There's world sheet supersymmetry, which is the one in the 2D theory that you're talking about, And there's space-time supersymmetry, which is the one in the ambient space that typically is thought of as maybe a target of maps from the world sheet in. That's one way to build a CFT, a 2D CFT. So, so there's a danger of getting those two things confused. Certainly, the symmetry algebra of a superconformal theory should have its own 2D supersymmetry. But then, if you're doing it in the context, like I'm doing now, of a space-time, the space-time could also have supersymmetry.
Now I feel better about being confused.
Yeah. So let me just point out the sort of nice mathematical way of describing this double cover, which is to use what's called the Clifford algebra of this orthogonal group. So how do you do a Clifford algebra? You take the free tensor algebra on, so I've got SOPQ. SOPQ is going to act on a vector space V by the usual so-called vector representation. It's the standard P plus Q dimensional representation of SOPQ. And so that's the space with a quadratic form on it. And what I do is I take the free tensor algebra. So it's the tensor product from n equal 1 to infinity of the nth tensor powers, not symmetric, of V. I'm just forming things that look, sorry, it's the direct sum. I'm just forming things that look like sums of products of group elements, and any number of group elements are allowed, but in this kind of direct sum, I should have only a finite number of terms for any particular element, right? And then you mod out by a relation which says that X tensor X minus the quadratic form evaluated on X times the identity element, that's the standard element in tensor 0 of V, is equal to 0. So what does this Clifford algebra construction do? Well, if we weren't working with a non-degenerate form, but if we were working with a completely degenerate form, then, so this is Clifford algebra of a quadratic form on the vector space. So V with this quadratic form. So if Q of X were identically 0, then this Clifford algebra is just the familiar exterior algebra on the vector space. All I would be saying then is that since everything has norm 0, I would be saying that X tensor X is equal to 0 for all X's. And if you look at what that says for like X plus Y, tensor X plus Y, it tells you that the only remaining tensors are the totally anti-symmetric tensors. So I get the anti-symmetric tensor algebra. So this is a generalization of that, a sort of modification of that. People have used capital Q for this for a long time, and it's so tempting to say this is like a quantum deformation of the exterior algebra, because there's a Q there, and it's sort of a deformation of the algebra rules, but that's really a bad joke. Anyway, I have this Clifford algebra, and so it's an algebra over the reals, which means that there's a multiplication in it, and it's defined over the reals. And so there are things called Clifford modules, which are just spaces M on which the Clifford algebra acts by multiplication, right? This typical module definition. Modules like a vector space, except instead of using a field, I'm going to use an algebra. And the cool thing is that this. All right.
You could just lift it up.
Yeah, I'm just going to leave it the way it is and put my phone someplace else. The spinner group, spin PQ or whatever, is contained in the units of this Clifford algebra. And so having Clifford modules, I automatically get representations of the spinner group, and in fact, the dictionary goes both ways. So there's a nice approach to understanding the representation theory of the spinner groups by classifying Clifford algebras. And again, this is over the reals. We're working over the reals to talk about this. So there's a variant, which is to look at complex Clifford modules. So instead of looking over the reals, I look over the complexes. And if I have a complex Clifford module, so the only real difference, I'm going to put a subscript C just to emphasize that it's complex. If I have a complex Clifford module, it turns out that the action of the Clifford algebra, the action of the spin die, commutes with the multiplication by diagonal things of complex norm 1. Actually, I could do C star there, but I want a compact group when I'm done, because I'm doing Lie theory of compact groups. So there's a U1 action which commutes with this, which is just essentially the left action on the this guy is a complex vector space by the U1 sitting inside of C. And in fact, the central element here acts the same way as the 180-degree rotation, otherwise known as -1, acts there. So that's a trivial action. So what you get from a complex Clifford module in a natural way is a representation of the group spin cross U1 mod this -1, -1 element. And that's a group that's called spin C. So I was discussing real fields, but actually I'm about to discuss complex fields, theories with complex-valued fields, can sort of combine real fields to get complex fields. And in those theories, it can often be the case, so having these complex-valued fields should mean that I have some symmetry group, and as I'll describe for a class of theories in a moment, I'm interested in this being a gauge symmetry, so this will be a gauge symmetry. But by the way, the action of the spinner group is some part of the gravitational symmetry, which is a gauge symmetry in these theories, but I'm not really going to focus on that aspect. I'm going to focus on the gauge nature of this guy. And so if I'm using complex fields, then I have the potential of dealing with this group instead of the spin group as the natural group to use. And the place where it makes a difference is that if I have an arbitrary spacetime, and for example, so having, as I sort of indicated before, having a gauge symmetry typically means that there is some bundle in which on which the gauge symmetry is acting. And having a spacetime with a bundle, if that bundle has a spin C structure in this appropriate sense, then I can define basically a complex fermionic field with appropriate constraints on the gauge symmetry of that field. So what I need in my theory in order to make that work is something called a spin charge relation, which has a rather recent history. So spin charge relations were discussed for three-dimensional theories by Beloff and Moore some years ago, not three-dimensional, for four-dimensional theories, but Beloff and Moore some years ago, and then they reappeared in the last couple of years in condensed matter physics in the study of three-dimensional condensed matter systems, where the essential point is that there is some quantization relation for the gauge field, which is unusual when in the presence of this, if you have this spin-charge relation, then the correct quantization condition for the gauge field is a little bit unusual, and what it amounts to is the statement that we can really work with this spin-C bundle rather than something else. So that's sort of the mathematical translation. And what it says, if I have this U1 gauge symmetry, just to completely make things clear, I'm going to start referring to that U1 gauge symmetry as an SO2 gauge symmetry. It's the same group, it's just, we'll see why. If it's true that all of the fermions have half-integer charge, and all the bosons have integer charge under this SO2, well, that really meant that the correct thing to use was spin-2, the double cover of that, if you wanted to do the quantization correctly, but the correct version of the quantization, it looks like this. And then, in fact, you see that the action of minus one on both sides is the same, so that the true symmetry group for those particular theories is this quotient group like this. So,
can I ask a question?
Yes.
There are gamma matrices, and are they called Clifford algebra as well?
Yes.
And they're not the same thing.
They are the same. Exactly
they are
the
same
thing. Yeah. So a physicist will make a Clifford algebra by gamma matrices. That's right. Yeah, I you had me doing indices for a whole quarter, but I don't like indices, so I try to do things in index-free notation whenever I can. I have nothing against indices. I was just raised without them. So, so absolutely, the algebra of gamma matrices is a Clifford algebra. Okay, so I wanted to write down for you the correct quantization condition. And so the way to say it is that if you have your exterior derivative of your gauge field, I guess that's using script A, and you want to integrate that over some oriented two-cycle, the thing to say is that you want to, the correct quantization condition is to say that the integral of that over a two-cycle should be half of the integral of what's called the second Stiefel-Whitney class and that's the thing which measures whether we have this kind of structure in the bundle or not. So having a bundle with a spin-C structure, it's a U1 bundle with a spin-C structure, is the same thing as having the Stiefel-Whitney class being the reduction of an integral, half of an integral class, and those are the bundles that that we would use for spin C. So the kind of lesson here is if I'm given a theory, given a U1 gauge theory with this kind of spin charge relation, then I can put it on spin-C backgrounds, arbitrary spin-C backgrounds. I don't necessarily need a spin structure to formulate the theory. And in fact, the key thing is going to be a U1 bundle that sort of measures this property, whose second Stiefel-Whitney class I'll study. Or what I would prefer, instead of the U1 bundle, is a C-star bundle, a C bundle, where the U1 inside of the C induces the thing that I want. And then it turns out that it's the first churn class of this complex bundle that corresponds to this Stiefel-Whitney class in the mod 2 reduction scheme. All right, so I'm about to show you that type 2B string theory has a spin charge relation, and therefore I can formulate it in a nice way on such backgrounds. So actually we start with type 2B supergravity. Okay, so what's a supersymmetric theory or a supergravity theory? Well, as I've already suggested, there are going to be a collection of fields, both bosonic and fermionic, in this theory. There's going to be some kind of supersymmetry transformation. And in fact, the type 2 theories, these are 10-dimensional theories, and they actually have two supersymmetries. So I have a whole sort of space of supersymmetries, two-dimensional real space of supersymmetries. And there's a natural SO2 which rotates the supersymmetry. Well, to formulate it with an SO2 rotating the supersymmetries, so that SO2 rotating the supersymmetries may or may not be a part of the formulation that you give, but there is that possibility. And so how did people work out these supergravity theories? Well, they want their fields to have terms in the Lagrangian which make them behave like physical fields, so some kind of so there are standard terms in quadratic terms in the Lagrangian, or terms involving derivatives in the Lagrangian, kinetic terms which you put in for these fields, and then you want the supersymmetry transformations, which you are very restricted just by kind of a representation theory analysis. You want them to preserve everything, and so you discover that there have to be other fields and they have to fit together in certain ways, and the whole thing is very constraining. But it turns out, and Green and Schwartz were the ones to write this down in the early 1980s, before their famous, more famous work, it turns out that by noticing the possibility of a big global symmetry for this theory, you make your life a lot easier in formulating the type 2b supergravity. So the type 2b supergravity, particularly in this formulation of Green and Schwartz, has a global symmetry of SL2R. So what's the difference between a global symmetry and a local symmetry? Well, the local symmetry, as I explained, is going to act from point to point, but the global symmetry is simply going to act on the whole structure by itself. We're only going to use the finite dimensional group of symmetries. We're not going to use maps from space-time into a symmetry group. We verify that once we have had the idea from the representation theory structure that there might be such a global symmetry, then trying to make a Lagrangian for the theory, well, you can't actually make a Lagrangian for this theory, but trying to write down equations of motion for this theory, which would come from the mythical Lagrangian, you can exploit this global symmetry to great effect. And so what are the fields in the theory? Let me just describe here the bosonic fields. So the bosonic fields consist of a complex scalar in the upper half plane, is the way it's usually described. So what is a scalar field? It means it's a trivial representation in space-time. Then I have things like one forms and two forms and three forms as a typical thing, and there's a pair of two-form fields. Now, I'm not going to be emphasizing the gauge aspect of this, but actually in the Lagrangian, so two-form fields are kind of like connections on bundles in that it's really their exterior derivatives or their local exterior derivatives, which are three forms. So they have a field strength, which are three forms. So that's a pair of three forms. And they're going to be called H1 and H2. And then I have a four-form field with self-dual field strength. Yeah, so this is 10 dimensions. Self-dual field strength. And it's the presence of this field which means that we don't really have good ways of writing Lagrangians. So what does that mean? It means I've got a four-form in 10-dimensional space-time, but I'm locally taking its exterior derivative to get a five-form in 10-dimensional space-time. However, I'm going to insist that that five-form be equal to its own Hodge dual. So that constraint of having the form equal to its own Hodge dual is something that's very hard to implement. And then for fermions, I have two gravitinos. And I have the graviton, of course. I have the metric, fluctuating metric, which is a graviton. So I have two gravitinos and two other fermions. And these are usually called spin 3/2, and these are usually called spin 1/2. This really transforms in the spinner representation I was discussing. This transforms in an irreducible representation, which is the highest weight representation inside the tensor product of the vector and the spinner. Okay, there are two different spinner representations in dimension 10, and here I'm using two copies of the same spinner representation for both of these guys. That's important. So people write down these fields, and then they have this SO2 inside the thing, and what Green and Schwartz realized was that there was a very natural way to describe the whole theory, and that was to use what's called the covariant formalism, which will introduce a U1 or an SO2 as an explicit gauge field. So in the covariant formalism, the upper half plane is SL2R mod SO2. And the action of SL2R on the upper half plane here takes A, B, C, D in SL2R to the linear fractional transformation A tau plus B over C tau plus D. That's what tau maps to under this guy. I have a pair of two-form fields, and so it just acts on the pair of two-form fields, although I have to say that you're supposed to use the contragradient representation. So I'm going to multiply the matrix by, D minus C minus BA. So I'll multiply by that matrix, take that combination, and the four-form field and the fermions are all neutral under the SL2R action. So the covariant formulation promotes this SO2 to a gauge group for the theory, and it replaces the H by a pair of complex scalars, omega 1, omega 2, with omega j complex, and it imposes a constraint, and that's the sort of thing you can do in Lagrangians, Lagrange multipliers and all that. It imposes a constraint which says that the imaginary part of omega 1 times omega 2 bar is equal to 1. And now the SL2Z action is left multiplication by this real 2 by 2 matrix. So I'm going to have SL2R cross SO2 acting. And the SO2 action is cos theta minus sine theta, sine theta, cos theta, multiplying from the right. So if you mod out by the right action, you actually end up recovering the upper half plane exactly. That's how the SL2R mod SO2 is implemented. In fact, the pairs of complex numbers, omega 1 and omega 2, such as the imaginary part of omega 1 and omega 2 bar is equal to 1, is in a natural way a copy of SL2R. So I really have, in a way, SL2R multiplying itself there. I'm very sorry. I said this wrong. So if I'm writing it in terms of omega 1 and omega 2, I should really have written e to the I theta. I could have written instead, as I said, an explicit 2 by 2 matrix which shows that this guy is a copy of SL2R itself. And it's not hard to show that the imaginary part of omega 1, omega 2 bar is the determinant of that 2 by 2 matrix, and that if I act in this form, I could put the ABCD over here, and I could put the cos theta, sine theta, maybe it's minus sine theta, cos theta over here. And I have completely equivalent actions. Right, so this is the form in which it's clear that I'm modding out SL2 by SO2. But this is a sort of more convenient form to write it in. Okay, but now this SO2 actually ends up acting on things. So this SO2 is actually, as I suggested, rotating the supersymmetry. So in this covariant formalism, you actually have to have an SO2 charge. And the SO2 charge charges are plus or minus a half and plus or minus 3/2 for the gravitinos and the fermions. So what that means is that where I had e to the I theta, here I'm going to act, well, I've got two eigenvalues, eigenspaces, one looking like e to the I theta over 2, one looking like e to the minus I theta over 2, and similarly for the fermions. And the let's see, the four form is the two form and the four form, two forms and the four form are neutral under the SO2 action. Okay, this is called the covariant formulation of type 2b supergravity, and it has a charge spin relation, which you see directly. I've formulated it with an SO2 action, and then the charges under SO2. Were actually half integral instead of integral. So you lift it to the double cover, you lift it to the spin group, but then you take the quotient by that common minus 1 in between the two, and you find a better group, which is this double cover group, the spin C2 group, which includes the action of the 10-dimensional spinner, spin C10, 9-1. Includes the action of the 10-dimensional spin group, 9 plus 1-dimensional spin group, as well as this SO2 or U1 symmetry. So that's, you can, it's papers from the early 1980s that give this formulation, and you can find everything that I've said in those papers. So what do people do when they don't have a gauge invariant formulation of a theory? Well, they want to make computations, so they do something called gauge fixing. Yeah, there. I'm sort of running, this is going longer than I thought it would, which probably is a good thing because it probably means that I'm communicating more. Let me just mention a few things. Let me not mention. You can get the gauge field for this SO2 guy directly out of the complex fields that I'm looking at. This turns out to be the gauge field. And it can be written in more invariant terms. Let's see. So omega 1, omega 2 is always gauge equivalent to something of the form, 1 over root n tau, tau e to the I theta, and 1 over root m tau. So, also e to the I theta. So everything is equivalent to something in that form, and the gauge field could be written in the terms of the omegas, or it could be written in terms of tau. Tau is the gauge invariant quantity, and the most of the discussions of this type 2b theory are phrased in terms of tau rather than in terms of the omegas, and the gauge field can be written in those terms as well. Okay, and the theta is the thing we want to eliminate from the gauge field, and so aside from a little shift, it looks like a standard gauge field.
Question?
Yeah.
This area, that's the gauge field corresponding
to the SO2. So I promoted the SO2. So in the original formulation, I maybe thought the scalar took values in the upper half plane. Now I've promoted the fields to 3 fields, 4 real fields with 1 constraint, and I put in this SO2 gauging. And then it turns out that, this sort of has to be true, that if you gauge fix, you eliminate the gauge field, and so the gauge field should be expressible in terms of the thing the field strength for the gauge field together with the gauge invariant quantities like tau.
So in typical formulations, we don't have this gauge field because we
you can integrate it out, right? I mean,
yeah.
you don't have to have it, but I want it because it shows me. So if I have a gauge theory and I manage to do a gauge invariant formulation, I might miss things like bundles that transform in a certain way being part of the background. So it's useful to have this formalism. Okay, so what do I do if I have a gauge theory? typically I gauge fix. And that means I choose some configuration of my omegas which sort of obey some condition on the gauge field. And the gauge fixing that I want to take, for example, could be that the real part of omega is omega 1 is real and positive. Right? I could say about omega 2 as well. I want to really say about omega 2. Omega 2 is real and positive, is my gauge fixing. So if I take omega 2 to be real and positive, then the theta is set to 0, and so I don't have to use that gauge field. And if I make that choice all the way through, omega 2 real and positive, and impose that constraint and then proceed, that should be completely equivalent to any formulation that just involved tau. But here's an observation that was made by Gabardiel and Green in the 90s. And that observation is that this gauge fixing is not compatible. Of course it is compatible, but it's not naively compatible with the SL2R symmetry. In other words, if I multiply my pair of complex numbers in gauge fixed form, which is 1 over root m tau tau, and then 1 over root m tau, by an ABCD, then I'll produce C tau plus D over root m tau. And, that's no longer, never real, right? Because tau's in the upper half plane. So so long as C is not zero, that's definitely not real. So that was the lower component of this guy. Upper one was A tau plus D over root m tau. Well, the solution, of course, is that after applying this transformation, I should apply an appropriate Gates transformation to undo this. So I should choose a theta which will get rid of the phase of this thing. And if I want, the m tau part is already real, so if I want to get rid of the phase, I basically have to multiply by norm c tau plus d over c tau plus d, something like that. That will get rid of the phase. So I write that in the form e to the I theta, and that tells me the gauge angle, the gauge transformation to use, and everything is back to normal. So I understand in this form that the SL2R transformation acts on tau just fine, but is going to require an accompanying gauge transformation. And that means that although in the standard form although in this covariant form you don't see any SO2 action, what it means is I now have to use a compensation for the other places that gauge action appears. And the issue then becomes that the charges of the fermionic fields are not integral anymore. So what I really need for an action on the fermionic fields is something like the square root of this guy. And because I'm working in the upper half plane, that square root is not well defined. I don't know which of the two square roots I'm supposed to take in order to make the SL2R symmetry act. So I've taken to calling, for this covariantly formulated theory, I've taken to calling the product SL2R cross SO2 the bosonic symmetry group. So I've got a bosonic gauge symmetry and a bosonic global symmetry. But then I'm going to have to take square roots here to have the actual symmetry group, the full symmetry group. And the full symmetry group, as I'll explain in a minute, is something called the special Shimura group. And I only call it that because Shimura wrote it down in a paper in the 1970s. But the interesting part is what happens when you look at the SL2R, and what you get is the double cover of SL2R, which is called the metaplectic group, MP2R. So the standard lore has been that the global symmetries of type 2B string theory are SL2R, excuse me, type 2B supergravity are SL2R. And this analysis shows that actually, if you are careful about the fermionic fields, it's actually NP2R, although there is a spin-charge relation going around. So I'm going to take the center of this guy and cross it with the central element of the space-time spinner group at some point in the discussion. Okay. So now what happens in string theory is the following. So the type 2B supergravity has a quantum version known as type 2B string theory. When I say has, I mean has to physicists. It has to me too, but and what happens in string theory is that the SL2R global symmetry gets broken to an SL2Z symmetry, and then all symmetries of quantum gravity theories are supposed to be gauge symmetries, so I actually have an SL2Z gauge symmetry. It was global symmetry in supergravity, but it's actually a gauge symmetry in string theory. So my bosonic symmetry group in string theory looks like this. I could do a formulation without the SO2, and I'm still going to get the SO2Z. And then it's going to have this double cover, which is going to be the sort of integral Shimura group. But the key part that I want to focus on for the moment is this metaplectic group, MP2Z. So it's an interesting fact that pi 1 of SL2Z is Z. And there is a double cover. People focus on just the double cover for a number of reasons, one being that it extends to some higher rank groups. Integral symplectic groups of arbitrary rank have double covers like this, called a metaplectic group. Metaplectic group is a non-compact Lie group with no finite dimensional representation, faithful finite dimensional representations. So if you have a finite dimensional representation, you have to factor through SL2Z. We know about the representation theory of SL2Z, that's not a problem, but there are no faithful finite dimensional representations, but that's showing up here. So how is it described? Well, typically an element of MP2Z gets described by a matrix together with a function defined in the upper half plane. And the property is that if A is written in the form ABCD, then phi of tau squared is supposed to be C tau plus D. So, in fact, this was first studied by people who wanted to make sense of a modular form of half integral weight. If you know about modular forms, you know that C tau plus D is this standard modular factor that appears in modular forms, and you raise it to the weight, right? Well, if you had a square root of it, you'd be able to talk about things of half integral weight, and there is a modular form of half integral weight that's been known for a long time. The Dedekind eta function has half integral weight and a character for aficionados of modular form. Got to put in a character as well. And in fact, the Dedekind eta function is related to a lot of things about this story. So I'm out of time, but I do want to tell you I'm out of time. So the implication, the first implication, is that if you want to compactify, or rather, this type 2B string theory on a background X is possible if X has a spin C bundle. And there's a natural class of X's where this works. If I take X to be a complex manifold cross something non-compact, then the tangent bundle, the holomorphic tangent bundle of the complex manifold, so that's the tangent bundle equipped with a holomorphic structure, so Z is complex. Actually, it's okay for Z to be almost complex, is a natural spin C bundle, and its first Chern class, which was the relevant thing, is sometimes called the canonical bundle of the complex manifold. So I can put this type 2B theory on any complex manifold across another non-compact thing where I'm using the canonical bundle of the complex manifold to help define the bundle. And in fact, the bundle that I want is that canonical bundle. So it is TZ, or rather the top exterior power of TZ as a complex line bundle. And that's the bundle which sort of makes everything go. So in further parts of this story, you try to exploit the SL2Z bosonic symmetry or the MP2Z full symmetry and learn how to write down gauge fixed versions of that scalar field. And let me just quickly say that thanks to the theory of elliptic integrals, I can get a gauge fixed version of tau by choosing F, which is L to the tensor minus 4 value function, and G, which is an L to the tensor minus 6 value function. And this L is coming out of my story. And in this case, I'm expecting supersymmetry to be preserved, if that's true. Anyway, in this FG story, and then the way you get tau is by taking appropriate integrals, elliptic integrals. So this is the part I didn't have time to discuss today. You take a ratio of elliptic integrals to get tau. But anyway, the essential data for specifying the scalar fields is contained in this pair of L to the tensor minus 4 and L to the tensor minus 6 value functions. And you find exactly those thanks to the theory of modular forms, which transform according to an appropriate power of C tau plus D, which is the thing that's indicating how the SO2 transformation is working. So there are other pretty parts to this story, and maybe I will give part 2 of this talk in about a month, because other things are happening in between. Maybe I'll stop there. Questions? Yes?
Maybe I missed this at the end. So I know for Riemann surfaces, spin structure corresponds to a square root of a canonical bundle.
Right.
Is there a version, or do you
spin,
say?
Spin C would be just the canonical bundle.
It's just the canonical bundle. So.
Right. So I don't need the square root. Because I have that spin charge relation, I don't actually have to pass to that square root bundle.
So there is a, is this saying like there's a canonical spin C structure on?
On a complex manifold.
On a complex manifold.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I did go slowly at the beginning, but hopefully people follow a little bit. All right, so...